Hi everyone, I'm Ariel Cooksey, host of Malice. When violent acts occur, we tend to think the predators are monsters. Surely no human could do such things. But if we're honest, only humans commit malicious crime. And if you're like me, you want to know why. To find out, join me at Malice, wherever you listen to podcasts. Bye.
They murdered her.
A brutal murder that was the culmination of years of sustained abuse.
We just wish somebody could tell us what happened to her.
Welcome to Crime Labs. I am Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
Mufti Ismail Menk said, "Being so kind, polite, and cheerful towards the woman of the world holds no value when we cannot be such to our own wives, sisters, daughters, and mothers." Shafilia Ahmed was like most teenage girls growing up in the UK. She was determined and ambitious with a rebellious streak. She got good grades in school, wanted to wear the latest fashion, have a boyfriend, and to break free from her family home and live independently. The difference between Shafilia and most teenage girls is that she was born into and brought up around one culture, but was expected to abide by the rules of another. What would typically be seen as normal behaviour was seen as shameful by her strict parents. Shafilia resisted her parents' demands. She knew that she would be forced into an arranged marriage to an older cousin and wanted a different life for herself. The shame her parents felt she brought on the family name was intense, and this continuously took precedence over their daughter's well-being, happiness, and ultimately, her life. This is No Honour in Murder.
Shafilia Ahmed was born in Bradford, West Yorkshire, on July 14, 1986. She was the oldest of five children born to her Pakistani parents, Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed. Her family were Sunni Muslims and native Punjabi speakers from Uttam in Pakistan. They lived in the Great Sankey area in Warrington. Her father, Iftikhar Ahmed, came to the UK when he was 10 years old and was living an integrated lifestyle. Iftikhar had lived in Denmark in the early 80s, where he met and married Vivilone Anderson. Miss Anderson recalled Iftikhar being happy and embracing Western culture. He enjoyed the nightlife in Denmark and only changed around his Pakistani relatives. Vivi and Iftikhar were married in Copenhagen in 1982 and they had a son they named Tony. They lived together in Denmark until 1986, when Iftikhar was called back to Pakistan under the guise that his mother was unwell. He remained in Pakistan for a few months and then moved to Bradford, where he asked Vivi and their son to join him to start a new life. When she arrived, she was introduced to Iftikhar's heavily pregnant cousin, Farzana. When the baby was born, she was named Shafilia. After a health visitor came to the house, Iftikhar admitted that he was the little girl's father and that he had married Farzana while in Pakistan. He told his first wife that he had been promised to Farzana when they were children. He said he felt forced to marry Farzana after she threatened to kill herself if he did not. Vivi left the UK with her young son, who Iftikhar believed could grow up without his guidance in the Islamic ways because he was a boy. Farzana had grown up in rural Pakistan and had no experience of Western culture until she married her cousin in an arranged marriage and moved to the UK with him.
Iftikhar and Farzana moved to Warrington soon after Shafili was born, and they went on to have four more children, three girls and a boy. They chose to raise their children the Pakistani way, with Muslim beliefs, dress and culture. They were expected to behave as if they were living in rural Pakistan whilst living in Warrington. Although the family lived in a westernised area, there was a strong Asian community. The Ahmeds pushed their cultural and social attitudes on their children as forced expectations. The Ahmed children were stuck between living in an integrated society and segregating themselves to conform to their parents' impossible standards. Shafilia first came to the attention of the police when she was reported missing alongside her sister when she was just 11. Her parents reported her missing to the police on March 10, 1998. And both children were found safe and returned to their home the same day. As Shafilia grew into a teenager, her strength of character was apparent, as her defiance intensified. She was wearing makeup that was removed before returning to the family home. Affectionately dubbed Shaf by her friends, Shafelia attended Great Sankey High School, where she was an A-level student. On October 3rd, 2002, teachers at the school learned that Shafelia was being held against her will at home. She was being denied an education by her parents, but after a meeting between the school and her father, Shafelia was allowed to return. Shafelia would often have arguments with her parents over her, quote, westernized, unquote, behavior. They did not want her to wear certain clothes or integrate with people outside of her home. As punishment for any breach of their strict code, she would be locked in her room, starved, and beaten. She would be kept off school until the bruising went down. Her friend Sarah Bennett said that once, when Shafelia dyed her hair and wore false nails, Farzana had ripped the nails off and washed the dye from her hair, branding her a, quote, slut, unquote. The following month, November 25, 2002, Shafelia ran away from home again, and her parents reported her missing. She had just turned 16 that summer. Shafelia was found by a friend on a park bench with bags of her belongings. She told her friend that she had been locked in the house and not allowed to leave. The school mediated a meeting with her parents. After spending the night with her friend, she returned home the following day. On one occasion, a concerned teacher, Joanne Code, rang Shafelia at home after she hadn't been to school. She said, quote, I'm worried about you. Do I need to be worried about you? Unquote. And Shafelia replied yes. A few days later, she went back to the school with a cut lip and faded bruising on her neck. A referral was then made to social services. When a social worker came to meet Shafelia at school, she claimed she didn't want any social service involvement and the file was closed. At the end of 2002, the Ahmed family went to Blackburn, where Shafelia met Mushtaq Bagas. He gave her a slip of paper with his number on it and they began talking. Shafelia confided in him about the way she was being treated at home and how her parents were going to force her to marry her cousin in Pakistan. Shafelia sought Mushtaq's help escaping from her abusive home life. In January 2003, he drove to Warrington and collected her from her house in the dead of night. Shafelia snuck out of a window and the pair spent the next few days in Blackburn together.
Shafelia's parents reported her missing, and on February 3rd, Iftikhar went to the school, threatening to get Miss Code fired from her teaching position. Shafelia registered as homeless, citing she was afraid she would be forced into an arranged marriage in Pakistan, pleading by any means necessary to escape the trauma of her family home. Anne-Marie Woods, a senior homelessness officer, said that Shafelia told her she was staying with friends and had nowhere to live. Shafelia had written a note that said, quote, over the past few years, I've been experiencing domestic violence which has stopped me going to college on more than one occasion. They have also forced me to quit my job. From that, I had saved £2,000, which they took out of my bank account. But my fear is that my parents were going to Pakistan to get me married to someone and left there. Unquote. Shafelia just wanted to live a life that was typical of that of a teenager in Warrington, but her parents would not condone any behaviour that wasn't in line with the rules they had set out. 5 days later, on February 10th, she returned back home after her father went to her school in his taxi to wait for her. Melissa Palmer said she was with Shafelia when she spotted her father's car. Her friends froze in fear as Iftikhar grabbed Shafelia's arm and forced her into the car as she cried. Melissa said, quote, he told me to get out of the way and stay out of it, unquote. Melissa ran to the school and told teachers, who phoned the police, but when they interviewed Shafelia at the school, she said that the problems at home were sorted and she would return home. A week later, the Ahmed family travelled to Pakistan, the ideal situation here being that having Shafelia in Pakistan would correct her behaviour and remove her westernised ideas. It is believed that Iftikhar crushed up prescription sedatives and slipped them into Shafelia's drink in order to get her onto the flight. Shafelia's sister recalled her mother bringing her a drink to her room, and Shafelia appreciated the gesture, not knowing it was a ploy to get her to do as they wanted. In Pakistan, they attended a family wedding, and Shafelia became increasingly worried about being forced into an arranged marriage with a man 10 years her senior and being left behind in Pakistan. While staying with family in rural Punjab, Farzana remarked to her daughter that she wouldn't be coming back to the UK. She made the comment in the presence of others, so Shafelia knew her mother meant it. Shafelia made her way to the bathroom, and a few moments later, everyone heard her screaming in pain. When everyone went out to see what had happened, Shafilia was holding her stomach and there was an open bottle of bleach on the floor. She had attempted to take her own life, preferring death to the life she would live in an arranged marriage to someone she had never met in a country she didn't feel was home. Shafilia's sister recalled their mother's reaction. She looked distant and emotionally unattached from the incident, almost as if she thought, it's better she's done it herself. Shafilia needed emergency medical care. Although the results of her attempt on her own life were unsuccessful, the bleach caused severe esophageal and throat burns, along with other substantial damage. She was unable to eat properly for months. Alicia, Shafilia's sister, said that when she told her that she, quote, couldn't believe she had drank bleach and that she had done it to herself, unquote, Shafilia replied, what else was I supposed to do? Her father and two of her siblings returned to the UK without her. Iftikhar actually got a refund for £250 for Shafilia's ticket. When the hospital in Pakistan were unable to treat Shafilia's condition, Iftikhar returned to bring her home to Britain. After returning back to the UK on May 27, 2003, he rang 999 and she was taken by ambulance to a hospital in Warrington, where she was kept and treated for 3 months. Shafilia was warned to say that it was an accident, that she had mistaken the bleach for mouthwash. Her parents were by her bedside at all times. Her weight had plummeted to just 5 stone. They seemed, to all medical staff, like concerned, caring parents. But in reality, they were only worried about Shafilia speaking out about the abuse. Iftikhar had even told an Asian nurse not to speak to anyone bar them about his daughter. The nurse described them as a, quote, loveless family, unquote.
When Shafilia was discharged from the hospital, she was not allowed to go back to Great Sankey High School because her parents thought that that was where she had adopted the behaviour they believed to be so disgraceful. Instead, Shafilia was enrolled at Priestley Sixth Form College in September 2003. She was extremely bright and had ambitions to become a solicitor. She had a part-time job at a call centre in Warrington. On the 5th of September, she attended the hospital for more treatment on her damaged throat. The arguments at home had dissipated as Shafilia was finally broken to bend to her parents' will. She was allowed to have a mobile phone, but only on the condition that she left it in the kitchen when she returned home from work or college. Her school friends from Great Sankey High came looking for her, and despite Shafilia being upstairs, her mother told them she wasn't home. Her friends persisted, worried for Shafilia's safety, and Farzana told Shafilia to tell her friends to go away and to lie and say that she didn't want to speak to them ever again. Shafilia did as she was told because she wanted to make sure that she, quote, didn't cause any more trouble for them, unquote. The arguments began again when Shafilia dressed in non-traditional clothing. On September 10, 2003, Shafilia texted Mushtaq Bagas and asked him to meet her at college, but he didn't reply. He was getting ready for his own marriage. On September 11, 2003, Shafilia finished her shift at Manweb Call Centre, wearing a t-shirt and white trousers. The t-shirt she was wearing exposed her arms. Her mother collected her from work and was enraged that people could see her daughter dressed that way, in clothes that she believed to be indecent. Shafilia went home and she was never seen again.
In Britain, there are higher tendencies for South Asian women aged between 16 and 24 years old to self-harm or have suicidal thoughts. The statistics show at around 3 to 4 times higher than the national average. According to the Time to Change report regarding the attitudes towards mental health problems in the South Asian community, the older people, male and female, of age 65 years and above, who are powerful and well-respected in the community, attribute any mental health problems to laziness or people having a weak character. In general, mental health is seen as a taboo subject. Most members of the community who were diagnosed with mental health problems agreed that they were made to keep their diagnosis private. It wasn't something to even be discussed with immediate family. This is to preserve the family's reputation and status at all costs. With this mindset, it was not only mental health problems that were hidden, preventing community gossip that could negatively affect the family. This feeling of ingrained acceptance of secrecy, you could argue, was a catalyst to the mental health issues experienced by people in the community, especially in Shafilia Ahmed's case. A study published by the Muslim Council of Britain identified quote, serious problems, unquote, in the way British media reports about Islam or Muslims. They wrote that media reports on Muslims are a contributing factor in the rise of Islamophobia. Most British news outlets give a, quote, negative and misleading, unquote, coverage of the community. More than a third of the 10,000 news articles and broadcasts analysed, quote, misrepresented or made generalisations, unquote, about the community.
On September 18, 2003, Shafilia's former teacher Joanne Code reported her missing after overhearing her younger siblings and school friends express concern for her welfare. Normally, when Shafilia ran away, her parents would incessantly call her phone and report her missing to the police. On previous occasions, Iftikhar had even waited at Shafilia's school to drag her back home, despite her hysterical protests and cries for help. This time, her parents didn't call her mobile or report her disappearance to anyone. When the police came to the house, Iftikhar claimed that they didn't report Shafilia missing because the last time that they had, the police told them there was nothing they could do as their daughter was over 16. When her parents were questioned about where they thought she might be or why she left, they said they didn't know and presumed she was at a boyfriend's house. Iftikhar informed the officers that Shafilia had only taken Western clothes with her and seemed more disgusted and angered by her disappearance than at all concerned for her welfare. Iftikhar and Farzana claimed that they had nothing to do with their eldest child's disappearance and said that she was an undisciplined teenager who regularly ran away from home. When the police searched Shafilia's bedroom, they found songs she had written called Happy Families and I Feel Trapped. The police began to conduct press conferences. Some of the parents were not invited to attend, as suspicions grew towards them. They were not showing the concern and worry that parents of a missing child usually would. With rumours beginning to circulate regarding the part Shafilia's parents played in her disappearance, the media flew into full force in this narrative that prompted the Ahmeds to hire a lawyer. They were not happy with the way their family were being portrayed. They claimed their story was being distorted with racial motivation. Police were concerned about Shafilia's disappearance after speaking to her friends and teachers, but without any evidence, they had no reason to charge the parents.
She had run away several times, had the marks of physical abuse, had self-harmed and clearly feared the control her parents sought to impose upon her.
The authorities arranged for a covert listening device to be placed in the family home. Her father was recorded saying that the system in the UK works on proof, and quote, without proof, even if you kill 40 people, until it is found, they can't do anything to you, unquote. The device also recorded the Ahmeds discussing what would happen if the police found DNA evidence in the car. Without a clear admission of guilt, none of this was substantial enough for an arrest. The Cheshire Police Force held a press conference that brought the case to national attention, where Coronation Street actor Shobhna Gulati spoke. She said that she could relate to Shafilia's predicament. Shobhna touched on the fact that British Asians are often stereotyped and said the following.
I think she's definitely looking as though she's trapped between two cultures. She obviously wants to express something and feels that she's unable to do that. I believe that she's a very social girl, and that her friends and colleagues know of her work. She may have been involved in some kind of marriage arrangement where perhaps she doesn't want to be in that arrangement currently, because I believe she was studying to be a lawyer and her studies were very important to her.
Shobhna herself had a similar upbringing and said that if people could talk openly about the way they were feeling, things could move forward. DCI Jones said that there had been a major investigation into Shafilia's disappearance and that large areas had been searched, but they had not found her. He said, quote, we are very much convinced that the likelihood is that she has been a victim of a crime. It is unlikely that Shafilia is still alive, unquote. They had to investigate the possibility that Shafilia was killed for not complying with something or consenting to a forced marriage.
We have to investigate the fact that Shafilia may have been killed or murdered as a result of not consenting to something.
The detectives worked with Interpol and the Foreign Office to try and get more information about what happened when Shafilia was taken to Pakistan in February. There was no activity from her bank accounts and she had not been in contact with anyone since she left work on September 11, 2003. Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed were arrested December 18, 2003 for kidnap. Five other members of their extended family were arrested for allegedly perverting the course of justice. They were all released without charge.
Should have let us off months ago. We shouldn't have actually been on the bail in the first place. It's just proven the point that we've been telling the truth from the day one.
When the police are implying those things on you, right, without any evidence, there's nothing that we can do about it. It's just like, just bear it, like, until the truth actually comes out.
More was coming to light, but the truth was buried deeply between shame and secrecy.
Skeletal remains were discovered near the banks of River Kent in Sedgwick, Cumbria, on February 4, 2004, after a flood. Due to the length of time the body had been in the water, it had dispersed and was unidentifiable.
Decomposed remains found by the banks of the River Kent in Cumbria were found to be all that remained of Shafila's body.
On the 23rd of February, the body was identified as that of Shafila Ahmed, and a murder investigation was launched. DNA tests carried out on the right thigh bone meant that there were only one in a billion chance the bones belonged to anyone other than Shafila. Because of the condition of the remains, it was difficult to determine her cause of death, or even determine if all the remains were found. Part of her skull was missing, but there were no signs of blood on her clothing to indicate a head injury. She was identified by dental records and her clothing. During one of the press conferences after Shafila's body was found, Mr. and Mrs. Ahmed arrived, unannounced, and entered where their lawyer, Milton Furman, made the following statement. Quote, "No one can possibly overlook the fact that Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed have lost a beautiful and irreplaceable daughter. Nothing can change that cruel reality, a reality made all the more painful in view of the unsubstantiated allegations against them." Unquote. Mr. Furman went on to say that the Ahmeds would continue to deny any involvement in Shafila's death and would sue if necessary.
They strenuously deny any direct or indirect involvement in their daughter's untimely demise. If called upon to do so, they will not hesitate to defend their good and unblemished names in any court in this land.
Since the investigation had been moved to homicide, Iftikhar grew increasingly concerned and tried to sue and get the cause of death changed to deferred. Iftikhar had a reputation for being quick-tempered. Speaking to ITV News, his first wife, Vivi Anderson, said,
"He have a big temper, and I could imagine if he has been pressed up in a corner that he have could have done it, to kill his own daughter."
The Guardian also reported, quote, "Iftikhar Ahmed had once told a fellow taxi driver, 'I know the Lake District inch by inch. I have toured a lot of times over there. If you kill a man, nobody can find the body,'" unquote. There was other evidence of his reputation for having a quick temper. He'd broken a colleague's window and punched him, and was later prosecuted and fined for criminal damage. On another occasion, he roughly grabbed a customer by the necktie when he did not have change for a £10 note to pay his fare. As the investigation continued, community and family wall of silence came up in reaction. Even if any members thought Mr. and Mrs. Ahmed were wrong, they would not come forward. There was an unspoken rule where this would never be discussed. A member of the family needed to break ranks in order for the investigation to press forward. Building a solid case against the Ahmeds was growing increasingly difficult for the police, due to the "seen nothing, heard nothing" barrage.
In January 2008, an inquest was carried out into the death of Shafila Ahmed. Pathologist Dr. Alison Amore ruled out natural causes. She said, quote, "I could not establish cause of death. I gave it as unascertained due to the advanced state of decomposition," unquote. Because of the level of decomposition, it wasn't possible to confirm whether Shafila had died by strangulation or suffocation. There wasn't enough tissue to see damage caused by strangulation, and smothering leaves few marks. DCI Michael Forrester spoke of how the scene where the remains were covered was eerie. He said, quote, "I clearly saw the skeletal remains of a body. There was some clothing still there. Some of the vegetation had grown through the fabric of the clothing. The body had been there certainly since just after the summer of 2003, unquote. The presiding Cumbria coroner, Ian Smith, concluded that Shafila had been the subject of, quote, "a very vile murder," unquote. The coroner went on to say that Shafila had not received justice, saying, quote, "Her ambition was to live her own life in her own way, to study, to follow a career in the law, and to do what she wanted to do. These are just basic fundamental rights, and they were denied to her. I sincerely hope in the future inquiries will be carried out by the police and they will one day discover who did it, unquote. Mr. Smith spoke directly to Shafelia's parents and said, quote, "It must be remarked that the disappearance of Shafelia was reported to the police by Joanne Code, not by the family. I think the police have put thousands and thousands of hours into this inquiry, and I think they've not always had the total cooperation from the wider family that they might have had." Unquote. He believed that Shafelia's impending arranged marriage was an integral factor in the build-up to her death, saying, quote, "She did not want to be married, full stop, at this point. She wanted to forge ahead with a career. She did not want to stop her studies and she did not want to live abroad. Rightly or wrongly, she feared all these things might happen." Unquote. The verdict was that Shafelia's death was an unlawful killing. Now Superintendent Garrett Jones said that they would bring her killer to justice. After the hearing, Shafelia's parents' solicitor said, quote, "The Ahmeds disagree with the decision of the coroner's court, and they are currently receiving advice regarding appealing the decision of the coroner by judicial review." Unquote. The following month, February 2008, Superintendent Jones appeared on Crime Watch and spoke about how Shafelia's body was disposed. He believed that there were numerous people involved in the death and cover-up of Shafelia's murder.
"Clearly someone has gone into some length to dispose of Shafelia's body. I can't see that being a stranger. Someone connected to Shafelia has done that."
The same month, the Ahmeds were interviewed by BBC Nightline. Iftikhar believed that the investigation was prejudicial against him and his wife because they were Pakistani Muslims.
"From what they come up with is to say that you're a Muslim family, Pakistani culture, this is the way you people are."
When the interviewer asked if Shafelia was going to be forced into marrying someone, Iftikhar replied,
"No, because the daughter does not want to be married yet. She was still under education. She wanted to make something of herself. Until that such time, she's nowhere near want to be have anything to do with the marriage, which is fine."
Iftikhar continued to speak about the bias he believed they faced and how the stereotype of being a Pakistani Muslim was the only reason they were being implicated in their daughter's death, because of their religious and cultural background.
"That is the attitude they come up with."
"Suggesting what?"
"Suggesting that the you Muslim people do these things."
"Do what?"
"Would we kill our own daughter?"
"Or would you?"
"Never. Couldn't even dream of it."
After protesting their innocence, he said they wished they knew what happened and appealed for anyone with information to come forward.
"I mean, we just wish for somebody could tell us what happened to her. We appeal to the public, if anybody knows anything, to come forward."
For the next 2 years, nothing happened. Shafelia's killer was still walking free.
In August 2010, Farzana and Iftikhar were living a much quieter life. There was a marked decrease in press coverage. The police appeared quieter and other news took precedence. That is until the Ahmeds were thrust back into the spotlight on the 25th of August when an armed robbery occurred in their home. Three men broke in armed with a gun, a hammer, and an iron bar. Farzana and three of her children were tied up by masked men. Their son was kicked to the ground, and Mevish was hit in the shoulder with a hammer. The property was ransacked, and a significant amount of cash and jewellery was stolen. The Ahmeds immediately accused their daughter Alicia of orchestrating the robbery. Shortly after, Alicia was arrested. When speaking with press regarding the arrest of their daughter, the Ahmeds stated Alicia had fallen in with a, quote, "bad crowd," unquote, which mirrored the way that they had described Shafelia's behaviour years prior. In the summer of 2010, Alicia had left home. She was 22 and a law student. Following her behaviour, she'd been a victim of hostility from her parents and siblings alike. Alicia had accumulated debts in adulthood. Following the robbery, Alicia Ahmed was arrested and questioned. This provided an opportunity for Alicia to be safely in police custody with no parents around. Alicia took this opportunity to agree to cooperate with the police regarding the robbery, admitting she was aware the purpose of the crime was a robbery, although she denied knowing they would be armed. She had let them into the property that day and remained untied while the rest of her family's hands were taped up. She pleaded with her family to listen to the men and do as they said. Alicia then requested to talk to them about a different crime entirely. She was finally confident enough to speak up about the death of her older sister, Shafelia.
On the 31st of August 2010, Alicia Ahmed provided a police witness statement implicating her parents in the death of her sister Shafelia, providing a harrowing and detailed step-by-step account of the events leading up to the murder that her and her siblings had witnessed.
Alicia Ahmed was involved in a robbery committed at the home of her parents. While in custody, as officers spoke with her, 7 years of silence fell away. Alicia found the courage to tell the truth about her sister's death. For the first time, officers understood fully the terrible sequence of events which took place in the Ahmed family home on the night of Thursday, the 11th of September, 2003.
During Alicia's trial in 2012, the sentencing judge said, quote, "The psychiatric evidence is that the unpredictable violence throughout your childhood and the absence of ordinary parental protection changed and distorted your personality even before your sister's death," unquote. On the 2nd of September 2010, Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed were arrested on suspicion of murder and bailed pending further investigations. 1 year and 5 days later, on the 7th of September 2011, the pair answered bail and were charged with murder. They were remanded in custody. A week later, they were released on bail by Manchester Crown Court to await the trial the following year.
The murder trial began the 21st of May 2012 at Chester Crown Court. Giving evidence in court, Alicia stated that Shafelia lived a, quote, "secret life that she didn't want her parents to know about. I think she found it difficult, which is why it emerged she was living a life my parents didn't know about. It was kind of a secret life as well," unquote. She detailed how, if Shafelia came into conflict with her parents, she would be, quote, "physically abused," unquote. The evidence provided gave an insight into the night the murder took place, stating that their mother Farzana had uttered the final command to her husband, quote, "let's finish it here," unquote. Shafelia's parents stuffed a plastic bag into her mouth as she sat on a chair in the family home. She was held down by one parent whilst the other stuffed the bag down her throat, blocking her airways and ultimately suffocating her to death. Alicia described as she recalled her sister's eyes being wide with shock. She was kicking at her legs and struggling to breathe. Alicia remembers being frozen to the spot, in utter fear. She eventually saw her sister's legs stop kicking and her body became lifeless. The children fled to their bedrooms in shock at what they had just witnessed. Alicia recalls seeing her father carry Shafelia's body out to his car wrapped in plastic, but not before she had seen her mother in the kitchen sorting flowery patterned sheets, tape, and bin bags. Arguably, the most haunting aspect of this murder is that, according to Alicia's testimony, all of the children were witness to the murder, the youngest being just 7 years old at the time. They were immediately warned to tell anyone who asked about Shafelia that she had run away. A horrendous secret to ask them to keep, and a tremendous pressure of guilt and torment to endure for years to come. Female children had all suffered abuse, whether it was as brutal and constant as that of Shafelia, we don't know. But at one point or another, they had all tried to leave and had been coaxed back just as Shafelia had been prior to being drugged and dragged to Pakistan. The divided loyalty is evident as Alicia had denied any abuse towards Shafelia at the hands of her parents as a younger teenager, shortly after her sister had been reported missing. She had told friends about the murder but soon retracted her comments and lived at home in silence and denial, a far cry from the young woman who gave evidence against her family at the trial. The court fell silent as Alicia sobbed behind a burgundy velvet screen, just feet away from her mother Farzana, who wept in the well of the dock. Her father simply stared ahead, his face devoid of any emotion. Alicia wasn't alone. Her sister Mavish had detailed the same events in letters previously given to a friend, Shaheen Munir. Seeing Alicia give evidence in court had a knock-on effect and urged Shaheen to bravely come forward to reveal evidence she had kept in confidence for Mavish. Years prior, Shaheen, a friend of Mavish Ahmed, had noticed a change in her. She asked if there was anything she wanted to talk about, but Mavish was evidently filled with fear. The girls agreed to exchange letters. They had arranged a covert operation in which Mavish gave Shaheen letters detailing the events of the night Shafelia was murdered. Mavish had later asked for the letters back. Shaheen had, unknown to Mavish, taken copies for herself. When Shaheen made her statement, she produced the letter copies, and Mavish was pulled for questioning. Mavish supported her parents' defence. She claimed her writing in these letters was purely, quote, "fiction," unquote. The final and fatal assault was triggered by an argument over Shafelia's choice of clothing to work that day. She was wearing a t-shirt, hooded cardigan, and tight-fitting trousers. Farzana had picked Shafilia up from a part-time job in a call centre and they started an argument in the car. As history deemed, the arguments continued at home, which led to abuse at the hands of her parents. But this time, it ended in Shafilia's death. While three of the Ahmed children still supported their parents, it was one of their children that would seal their fate. The turning point and the most damning factor in the trial was Alicia's bravery. She had summoned all of her courage 2 years earlier, and she did it again in court.
Even more courage was required for Alicia to stand up in court. In the presence of the parents who had murdered her sister and the siblings who had stood by in horror and watched, and tell the truth again. As she recounted Shafilia's last moments to the court, we caught a glimpse of the transfixed and terrified 12-year-old that she was then. Her evidence against her parents was compelling and disturbing. I know the giving of this evidence has had a significant impact on her life. Her courage has been driven by her determination to achieve justice for Shafilia.
Midway through the trial, Farzana Ahmed changed her account of what happened. She had been denied bail the previous day, and in what seemed like a last-ditch attempt at freedom, she blamed Shafilia's death on her husband. For 9 years, she claimed to know nothing about her daughter's disappearance, but suddenly she spoke out about how Iftikhar had killed Shafilia, and out of fear for her own life, she didn't report it to the police. She claimed she had tried to intervene when Iftikhar attacked Shafilia, but was struck in the face, and was told that if she cared for her life or that of her children, she must never speak of it again. Iftikhar was undeterred in his stance of innocence. Despite his wife's claim, he said he loved her, quote, to bits, unquote, and that she wasn't telling the truth. After just 2 days of deliberating, the jury found Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed guilty of the murder of their daughter. Mr. Justice Roderick Evans said at Chester Crown Court, quote, on the evening of 11th September 2003, you berated her for her behaviour and, in temper and frustration, you two suffocated her. It was you, Farzana Ahmed, who said to your husband, quote, finish it here, unquote. While I accept that there was no pre-existing plan to kill Shafilia that night, that remark, together with the evidence relating to whether or not Shafilia survived the drinking of bleach, drives me to the conclusion that you two had previously discussed the way that you might ultimately resolve the problem which Shafilia presented for you. Your problem was that, in what you refer to as your, quote, community, unquote, Shafilia's conduct was bringing shame upon you, and your concern about being ashamed in your community was greater than your love of your child. In order to rid yourselves of that problem, you killed Shafilia by suffocating her in the presence of your other four children. Thereafter, you got rid of her body by dumping it or having it dumped in an undergrowth on a riverbank in Cumbria, and you told your children what to tell anybody who asked about the disappearance of Shafilia, unquote. Speaking about the impact on the other Ahmed children, the judge continued, quote, you killed one daughter, but you have blighted the lives of your remaining children. Alicia escaped, but she is unlikely to be able to avoid the legacy of her upbringing. Mevish, after a period of trying to live independently, was recaptured and brought home, and has since become compliant with your wishes. She came to court and was placed in the sad position of having to deny her own words in order to try and help the parents whom she, and no doubt all your surviving children, still care for, unquote. One of the children were aged just 7 at the time of the crime, and her name has been redacted. She'll be referred to as X in the following quote. The judge continued, quote, X was 7 when she saw Shafilia killed, and it's difficult to say what effect that's had upon her or will have upon her in the future. However, there is no difficulty in seeing the life which would have lain ahead of her had she returned to live with you. That future is graphically set out in the social services notes of contact sessions between you and her, in which you are recorded making clear your view of X's attitudes and what you expected in the future. As to Junyard, he remains supportive, especially of you, Iftikhar Ahmed. Whether that is simply out of filial affection or the result of the warped values you installed in him is impossible to tell, unquote. The judge had spoke earlier about Junyard's unwavering support of his parents and said, quote, I express no concluded view on whether Junyard played any part in the killing of his sister, but I have no doubt that, as a result of the distorted upbringing and values to which you subjected him, he told his surviving sisters within minutes of them seeing Shafilia murdered, by you, that Shafilia deserved it, unquote. Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed were sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 25 years. As the sentences were passed, Farzana wiped away tears, Iftikhar stood in silence, and the three children sobbed. Speaking outside the court after the sentence was passed, Melissa Powner, Shafilia's longtime friend, said this, quote, "We have waited for this day for many years. We have watched as her killers roamed free, yet today we heard those important words, words that have finally brought our friend the justice she deserves," unquote.
Shafilia was a caring, high-spirited and brave young lady, who even in her toughest times, always strived to remain positive and hopeful that one day she too would be able to live the peaceful and happy life that she deserved. If there is one thing that we pray will come from this, it is that her beautiful face and tragic story will inspire others to seek help that make them realise that this kind of vile treatment, no matter what culture or background they are from, is not acceptable and there is a way out.
Following the sentencing of Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed, a press conference was held by the Cheshire Police outlining the process and factors that led them to the successful conviction. They praised the bravery of Alicia Ahmed and the other witnesses who came forward. Superintendent Jones spoke about the relentless abuse Shafilia suffered and how cultural factors were at the heart of that abuse. Superintendent Jones felt that despite the warped moral code that provoked Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed to kill their teenage daughter, it was simply a case of murder.
They tried to control her, to force her into marriage, and to prevent her from expressing herself. When this failed, they murdered her, a vile and disgraceful act against their own daughter, a murder, someone they should have been very proud of. Over the years, many people have asked me, is this a so-called honour killing? For me, this is a simple case of murder, domestic abuse by two parents towards the children.
Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed had launched a campaign against the Cheshire Police Force, citing that they were being discriminated against because of their cultural and religious backgrounds. They tried to use the prejudice regularly faced by Muslims in the UK to pervert the course of justice and to maintain the facade of innocence. Their lie in the claim of discrimination they hid behind only fed into the media beast that continues to vilify minorities today. They killed their daughter because they were abusive and negligent to their children's social and emotional needs. There is no honour in murder. An honour killing is defined as the killing of a relative, especially a girl or woman who is perceived to have brought dishonour on the family. Shafilia's death can be characterised in different ways: child abuse, domestic violence, or a so-called honour killing. The term honour crime or honour killing can often reinforce the misconceptions that the act of violence or abuse is justified because the victim has brought shame upon someone. There is no mitigation of murder or the prolonged abuse Shafilia Ahmed suffered. Karma Nirvana is a national charity that was set up to support victims of honour crimes and forced marriage. The founder Jasvinda Sanghira said that there were approximately 12 honour killings yearly, as well as suicides and the countless women and men suffering in silence. The charity moved its base to West Yorkshire, which it had identified as one of Britain's most effective areas for honour crimes. Each year, the charity helps those rescued from other countries by the government's forced marriage unit. Here is a clip of Jasvinder speaking about the case.
This case doesn't shock me. Shafilia Ahmed will not be the last murder victim of such a crime. We're going to see many more, sadly, Shafilia Ahmed trials here in the UK. Because nobody wants to be whisked off to Pakistan or India or significantly harmed or even killed. And families will say and threaten murdering you if you don't adhere to an honour system.
There has always been a wall of silence surrounding honour crimes. Many are not reported due to the victim's fear of reprisals or death. Jasvinder said, quote, "The sooner people start to regard forced marriage in the same way they do domestic violence, the better it will be for those affected by it. It is not a cultural problem. It is abuse," unquote.
Shafilia Ahmed was 17 when she was killed, on the threshold of adulthood and what should have been the start of a new life. She would have been 34 years old now, and probably a successful solicitor. Her short life was spent on the edge, not free enough for the life she wanted, and not restricted enough for the life her parents wanted for her. Her strong will and brave defiance in the face of her parents' regime was ultimately the agitator that led to her untimely death. Shafilia wanted the fundamental freedom to choose how to live and who to love. Her parents cared more about their perceived reputation than they did for their daughter's life. In history, there have been many extraordinary people that have used writing as an expressive outlet and break from oppression. Shafilia Ahmed was one of those people, and this is her poem, Happy Families. I don't pretend like we're the perfect family no more. Desire to live is burning, my stomach is turning, but all they think about is honour. I was like a normal teenage kid, didn't ask too much, I just wanted to fit in, but my culture was different. Now I'm sitting here, playing happy families, still crying tears, but no, we're a happy family. I have these fears, I wish, for a happy family. I lay in bed hoping the next day would be better, but it was just a thought, because it never happened, no. But still I dream of this today, yeah, hey. I wish my parents would be proud of what I've done. Instead, it's you have brought shame or something else lame. I don't want to hear this no more. No, no, no. I feel trapped. So stuck I don't know what to do. The feeling is mutual. I don't know how to explain. I'm trapped. So trapped. Now you know where I stand. When I fall back, I've got nowhere else to land. I don't know how to say, I'm trapped, so trapped, I'm trapped with you. It was my last year in school, so happy with my friends I got lots to do. But came this day, when everything changed. I came home, it seemed like a normal day, but something wasn't right. I wish I could have changed this event, I should have killed myself instead. I'd rather have been dead, because now I have a burden on my chest. And no, it won't go away. The guilt, the pain. When I look back on things I could have changed, could have stopped, prevented, exchanged. But I had to turn out this way. Now I'm sitting on my window bay, looking at the rain, drowning sorrow and pain. Will this ever go away? I feel trapped, so trapped. I'm trapped, so trapped. I'm trapped, I feel trapped. But my family ignored.
Thank you for listening to Crime Lapse. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or even some feedback. You can follow us on social media at Crime Lapse Podcast and at Crime Lapse Pod. All the sources for this episode will be linked in the show description. Until then, stay safe, stay home.
Are you looking for a new podcast to check out? Well, if so, you should give my podcast, All the Things That Keep Us Up at Night, a listen. I talk true crime, missing persons, haunted locations, history behind spooky landmarks, urban legends, and I'll even dabble into some conspiracy theories. And at times, I give my opinions that nobody asked for. Hope you subscribe to my podcast, All the Things That Keep Us Up at Night. Stay spooky, you beautiful weirdos.